Welcome to After Deadline, the media podcast. I'm Kathy Fowler.
And I'm Mark Silverstein.
We are veteran TV news reporters who turn to the dark side and now work as PR and marketing gurus.
Our guest this week I'm fascinated by, an investigative journalist and author, along with articles for the New York Times, The Guardian, The New Republic, and more. She's written two books, The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, and The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. So much to dive into here. We are honored and excited to welcome Catherine Stewart to the show. So I am fascinated by the topic of Christian nationalism. I can't wait to ask a whole lot of questions. Give us a little background. How did you become a reporter? Did you always want to be a reporter? Print, TV? What motivated you?
Well, out of college, I got an internship with Wayne Barrett, who is a sort of legendary investigative reporter at the Village Voice. He wrote the first biography of Donald Trump. I believe that was published in like 88 or 89. He was researching a lot of the New York City scandals, Department of Transportation scandals, and things like that. And, you know, he was a really legendary guy. He was kind of a one-man journalism school. When I was in college, I used to wait for, you know, Wednesdays when we got the Village Voice to our library, and I would, you know, just like wait for it to arrive and eagerly read the paper, and always loved Wayne Barrett's column because he just seemed like the model of a really fantastic investigative reporter. So I was so honored when he accepted me as an intern. I was very shy at the time, and he taught me so much. He really kind of beat the shyness out of me. He taught me to go into a room full of people and find the person with the most light on them and ask them the one question that they didn't want to be asked. And, you know, he taught me to dig through, you know, he'd send me up to warehouses in the Bronx and tell me, you got to find such and such a document. And I sort of had to figure out how to do that. He taught me to follow the money. And he taught me that, you know, listening is really important. I think sometimes the hardest thing for us to do is to listen to people, listen to what they say and take them at their word. So I was very lucky to have been taken on as an intern by him. And a lot of the work that I do today, I still, you know, I'm able to sort of draw on some of those methods.
That's such a great lesson to walk into a room. Who was the first person you did that with? And were you nervous when you walked into the room, found the person with the most light on them and asked them the question they didn't want to be asked?
Oh, it was terrifying. It was some guy, I don't remember his name, but he was responsible for some massive real estate scandal. And actually the first story I ever published wasn't for the Village Voice. And it was about a real estate scandal, someone who had been, you know, doing things that he wasn't supposed to do. And I remember when I finally called him up and asked him the series of questions that made him, you know, realize that he knew what I had done, it's going to sound terrible, he started to cry on the phone. I felt so bad for him, but at the same time, he was responsible for bilking people out of a lot of money and a lot of people who couldn't afford to be bilked.
Were they real tears? Alligator tears? Which one?
I don't know if they were alligator tears. I learned that, here's what I learned from Wayne. You can be intimidated or frightened, but if the story needs to be told, you tell it anyway.
Yeah. And I mean, sometimes people feel bad, but sometimes they feel bad because they got caught. So, you know, did he feel bad about bilking people, or did he feel bad about the fact that you're calling him out on it and he's going to be publicly embarrassed? So now, some of the articles that you write are classified as opinion pieces. For example, the article in the New York Times headlined, "Christian nationalists are excited about what comes next." How would you classify yourself as a journalist? Are you an investigative journalist? Are you an opinion journalist? Are you both? I mean, what's your role in journalism?
I'm really an investigative journalist. I also don't, you know, pull any punches. I think that when stuff needs to be called out, I'm not going to both sides it. Extremely concerned about the rise of authoritarianism in America and also globally. I think that there's a kind of rise in the exploitation of religion that threatens liberalism across a number of, you know, liberal democracies and other countries around the world. I'm worried about the extreme polarization, the spread of disinformation and conspiracism. And so yeah, I mean, I guess you could call that advocacy journalism in a way, but I really see myself as an investigative journalist because my opinions draw from the facts.
Okay. I like that you said, I'm not going to both sides it, because I think a lot of journalism has or is in this catch 22, and especially because we were called liberal journalists for so long, right? The liberal media. And I'm like, gosh, if you look at Fox, CNN, OAN, Newsmax, now Twitter and Parler, if you, all those are owned, all those big voices or platforms are owned now by conservatives or Republicans. So I find it funny that we, you know, is still journalists still get classified as the liberal media. But I mean,
I would just reject that label completely. I think that sometimes folks who rely on fact-based journalism are allowing the other side to frame the conversation, and we should not be doing that. I mean, if you work for a publication that has a good fact-checking department, and most of the publications I write for do, if you write that something is a lake, they'll say, okay, is that a lake or is it an estuary? Or could it possibly be a pond? Like, you have to check every single fact, even if it's in the opinion section. Most of the pieces I have written for quote unquote opinion sections actually have a tremendous amount of reporting in them. And all of the facts are really carefully checked.
So how does the media fight that, being labeled as and liberal elite media?
And also, I think they get lazy. And I mean, there's some journalists who, I think we get confused about who journalists, true journalism and true journalists compared to bloggers or people who just have a platform and a mouth and haven't really studied journalism. Because, you know, when you said both sides of it, you know, we think to be equal and fair, we have to give 50% to that person and 50% to that side, even though even if 50% to that side is a complete and utter lie. I mean, that's not journalism, but that's what happens a lot of times. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you have one political party that has been taken over by conspiracism and is working really hard to spread misinformation, it makes, first of all, it makes their people easier to control because they've been separated from the facts and made immune to certain kinds of information and prone to believe disinformation, conspiracism. But it also makes our country less governable. And I think that that's by design, because it increases polarization, makes us less capable of addressing our real problems in our country, which we all share as Americans. And that kind of rise in chaos, I would say, in political polarization and chaos, and it clears the way for an authoritarian reaction. And I think that's by design. Look, I think our country functions best when we have two rational political parties that can engage in the politics of power sharing and compromise. But that's not what's happening right now. We have had 50 years of investment in the infrastructure of Christian nationalism, which is not just an ideology, it's also a political movement, an organized quest for power. This is a movement that for years the Republican Party made use of, because they delivered a reliable slice of the Republican vote, but really kind of kept outside the mainstream of the Republican Party. And frankly, at this point, the Republican Party is dominated by it.
And do you think there are any messages? I mean, I know as we sit here and talk, and you know, this may not post for a little bit, but as we sit here and talk, Tuesday's election still being sorted out. Do you think there is any kind of a message there to that, or... You know, the way I look at it, Christian nationalism, it's just, you know, they're in it for the long game. They don't let elections interfere with what they're doing.
That's absolutely true. I mean, look, remember DeSantis put out that promo ad saying that God sent him to save the nation in Florida. Look, he and his people know that Christian nationalism is the road to power in today's Republican Party. And they also know that when faith leaders and others denounce his abuse of religion, his exploitation of religion, leaders of that movement are going to quickly reinterpret that as an attack on God, as an attack on themselves, and they're going to use it to stoke paranoia among the rank and file and affirm that sense of, I would say it's almost like a tribal identity. You're an insider or you're outsider. You're one of the pure versus the impure. I mean, religious nationalism is really a way of kind of like saying who properly belongs in a nation, like who is properly American. And
let's get a definition of it just so we make sure we're all talking about the same thing. What is Christian nationalism? Is it Christian nationalism? Is it white Christian nationalism? Is it white nationalism? What's
the difference? White nationalism?
And there are differences, aren't there, Ray?
Sure. Well, Christian nationalism is not the whole of Christianity. Of course, it's not a religion. It is a political movement that involves the exploitation of religion for political purposes. So I think of it as combining two different kinds of things. It's, on the one hand, a set of ideas and ideology. On the other hand, it's a political movement, an organized quest for power. The ideology boils down to the idea that America was founded as a Christian nation, Christian here referring to a very narrow and reactionary conception of Christianity and all of its cultural implications. And this ideology says that all of our problems stem from the fact that we've forsaken this supposed heritage of our founding. But this ideology is really just a tool, like an incredibly useful tool for a leadership-driven political machine that turns this, you know, mythology, this deep story of our America's allegedly Christian founding into political power. And the strength of this movement is in its dense organizational infrastructure, which, you know, consists of a number of organizations, but that can be categorized. So there are networking organizations like the Council for National Policy that get leaders of the different organizations on the same page and bring them together with big donors of the movement. Then you have policy groups like the American Family Association or Family Research Council, legal advocacy groups like the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've got the Federal Society that plays an inordinate, you know, role in grooming talent and directing money toward the sort of shaping of the courts. You have net legislative initiatives, data initiatives, a messaging sphere, and all that. So that infrastructure is a means of persuading a large subsection of the American public to vote for the political candidates that the movement favors. And when then they can't get the results that they want at the ballot box, they can go through the courts.
Right. The courts of the judges that hopefully they appointed because they had been working on those judges for a long time.
That's part of the ground game. There is a long ground game.
And the school boards and the things that Democrats aren't looking at all, probably, right?
Michigan was a situation where they turned it around, I think, or it's turning around. Am I correct about that? That Democrats ungerrymandered the lines. They had a lot of success in local elections. Maybe I'm incorrect, there seems to be that they're in it for the long game, and they will continue to do schools, local councils.
So my question is, the Christian nationalists, this is their way to political power. But if you look at religion and you look at the country, less and less people, especially Gen Z and millennials, identify with a religion or organized religion, let's say. So is this long game that they've been doing, and is it going to work for the next generations who really don't identify as much? I mean, religion in around the world and in this country has actually decreased, right?
Well, this may be true, but what this ignores is that you don't need a majority of the population to win in election cycles or to dominate through the courts. All you need is an incredibly organized, disproportionately organized minority of people. And this is a movement that rejects democracy itself. It rejects the consequences of elections. It doesn't like leaders spread the big lie of Trump, you know, the Trump promoted. And I've heard in many of over the past 15 years that I've been researching this movement, I do a lot of my research by going to where they are. Like I go to right-wing conferences and strategy gatherings and summits and things like that. And you know, I've heard a number of folks like David Barton say, all you need to change the whole country is 10%, you know, in a country where 40 to 50% of people don't bother to vote, and an additional number have their votes essentially stolen from them through race-based, often gerrymandering, voter suppression tactics, et cetera, you really don't need a majority. So like, let's look at 2016. There's in 2016, 90, so this evangelical pollster named George Barna, who's sort of, he said only 10% of the country are the most devoted religious right supporters. He calls this group SAGECONS, which stands for Spiritually Active Governance Engaged Conservatives. He said 2016, 91% turned out to vote and 93% of those turned out to vote for Donald Trump. So if you have one group, a small group voting in such disproportionate numbers, you can really dominate, but gerrymandering has really, you know, stacked it against Democrats. So at another gathering I was at, Ralph Reed, who is one of the movement's very seasoned strategists, he was very cheerful about this. I'm going to try and paraphrase here. He said, if Democrats are up, he said, thanks to the Republican reapportionment advantage, it's what he called gerrymandering, the Republican reapportionment advantage. He said, if Democrats are up 1% to 3%, we win. If they're up 4% to 7%, it's a jump ball. And he said, if they're up 8 points or more, that's when they win. Think about that. Think about that. If Democrats are up 4 to 7 points, it's a jump ball. I mean, that's just disgraceful. And that's the consequences of all this gerrymandering that is driven by the radical right, because they don't believe in the legitimacy of the vote. I mean, this is a movement that does not believe in the legitimacy of democracy, of democratic elections. They engage in scapegoating, you know, LGBT Americans, people who happen to not be religious, members of religious minority groups, the wrong kinds of Christians, et cetera, you know, and they engage in this kind of, you know, demonization, language of demonization of their political other. So I do think it represents a serious threat to our democracy. I don't think we can understand what's happening in American politics today without understanding this movement and its people.
Well, what's its ultimate goal?
Power, access to public and private money, policies that privilege certain religious and political viewpoints in our laws and in society. So power is a great motivator.
Yeah. So what do you think, because basically what you're saying, it doesn't matter that their beliefs, you know, because it's really a political movement, not a Christian movement, because they're anti-Christian. Like everything they're doing is completely opposite of any of the Christian values, but it doesn't matter because it's a political movement. They don't necessarily need to co-opt people who really believe in the true, you know, values and morals of Christianity. Is that what you're saying?
That's not what I'm saying. It's not the whole of Christianity, what I'm saying. But in those spaces, people are worshiping with as much sincerity and passion as anyone. So, you know, all religions are really diverse. I think it's really false and presumptuous to say that we can know who is a true Christian and who's not, or who's a true Muslim and who's not, or who's a true Jew and who's not. I mean, I think that all religions are very diverse. And that movement, you know, some people describe it as, quote, the evangelicals. Well, it includes many evangelicals, but it does exclude many evangelicals too. And it includes representatives of a variety of both Protestant and non-Protestant religion. So the movement includes, you know, leadership includes a cadre of ultra-conservative Catholics. Think about Leonard Leo, who headed up the Federalist Society. All six current ultra-conservative members of the Supreme Court are current or former Federalist Society members. The movement includes many Pentecostals and folks who follow neo-charismatic faiths, folks like Lance Wallnau, who is a sort of new apostolic reformation figure. And then it also draws support from people who don't identify as Christian at all, or who really don't seem motivated by religion in any way. I think about Bar Said. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. He's a Jewish fellow from a billionaire from Chicago who just donated $1.6 billion to form what's called the Marble Freedom Trust, I think it's called. And he put Leonard Leo in charge of this. And it's donations for Republican politics. He's donating his support to the movement. If you think about somebody like Peter Thiel, who seems more motivated by, I would say, far right, almost libertarian ideology, something that I think people don't appreciate is that this movement, you know, they often think about it as the culture wars around abortion or same-sex marriage or some of the newer culture wars that the far right is pushing, like transport stuff. But I think of those sometimes as, you know, distractions from what the right is doing in terms of economic policy. The religious right, you know, in those spaces, I've heard so many speakers when they're not just talking to the rank and file, but when they're talking amongst themselves, talking about biblical economics. They get a lot of money from these, a subsection of America's billionaire class, people like the DeVos Prince family juggernaut or Sean Feiler or the Wilkes brothers and so many others that I talk about and power worshipers that are as committed, if not more committed, to low taxes for the rich or low minimal regulation for business, no regulation of the environment, minimal rights for the workforce, the kinds of policies that are going to intensify the economic divides that have already reached record levels in our society. So this is really not just a culture war. This is really a political war and involves a grab for economic policy and foreign policy as well as domestic policy.
So the fact that the abortion movement, like the Christian, not the Christian nationalist necessarily, because they probably saw that as a distraction to, but when some people go too far with, because abortion was on the ballot, you know, this last election, and it actually got a lot of people, Republicans even, and independents to go the other way and vote for, you know, Democrats instead of Republicans. So is there a way, you know, that was a distraction you said for basically the Christian nationalists, but are they going too far or is the group going too far that at some point they go too far and they won't be successful because they're pushing things too far too fast?
They're very clear that they want to ban abortion in all 50 states. This is what they've been saying for decades, and they can't roll back on that because for so long it was all abortion all the time. But I think they're just waiting for a favorable moment to start pushing that. But I think that this movement is very tactical and they recognize, you know, they're afraid of the pushback. So they've switched to these new culture war issues that they've created, this sort of fake CRT panic in the public schools or the issue of transgender, a bunch of transgender kids who they say, oh, they want to, you know, start playing in girls' sports teams and whatever you make of those issues. Those are complete distractions. I mean, you know, we've got this tiny little thing over here. And meanwhile, we've got some real problems in our country that we need to solve. It's also for them. I mean, issues for them are like a twofer, right? They reduce faith in public education. The movement has long held a deep hostility to public schools, which they see as non-sectarian, and therefore anything that fails to affirm their agenda is mischaracterized as oppressive to them. But they also want to siphon public money from public schools and divert it over to religious schools. And, you know, they've been pushing voucher initiatives for years and are having a lot of success in setting up a situation through the courts and through legal strategy that will allow church schools or religious schools to be funded on the same basis as public schools.
What's the next issue that they're going to bring up? Because, yeah, you know, if you look at the Daily Mail, which I do too many times a day, because it's fun. But it's not fun because they all on the election run up with crime and Democrat run cities, you know, trans, even in Florida where they, you know, wouldn't let people go. What are the dancers called or what are the anyway, what's the next issue that they're going to be bringing up to us? And we're going to go, oh, they're crazy, but they like it when we say they're crazy.
Yeah, you know, I think they're pretty happy with some of the culture war issues that they've cultivated in recent years. Like there was a study that Media Matters did about mentions of CRT.
Right. And, that's a lot.
Did you see that study where, like, prior to March of 2020, critical race theory was mentioned maybe like a couple of times, and then from a certain moment on, after Christopher Rufo, you know, at the Manhattan Institute, he's a right-wing activist, sort of decided that CRT would be a great sort of strategy for them. They all of a sudden, you know, thousands of references to CRT on Fox News. And that's what they do. They do their market testing. They sort of, you know, the movement is very strategic, and they do their market testing and they figure out how they can, you know, not just work the culture issues, culture war issues that they have, which I think they're sincere about. Like, I really think they're just getting started with, you know, overturning Roe. They're going to go after a range of individual rights, not just the right to reproductive care, the right to, you know, same-sex marriage and the like, but also the right to vote itself in all these different ways, I think, is being challenged. There are a couple of Supreme Court cases on the docket that are going to, you know, challenge that. But they're also very good at creating these new culture war issues in order to get the rank and file, you know, in a panic about, you know, all kinds of stuff. Yeah. Last thing I want to say, like, the, you know, when gender anxiety is the rocket fuel of the movement. So the trans stuff, you know, it's all about identity and sexuality. And so even though it holds very little relevance for public education and society overall, I mean, it does, you know, it decreases confidence in public schools. It provides a really great scapegoat. You know, they, you know, love to scapegoat sexual minorities. And then it also, you know, just gets a lot of the rank and file upset. And it's like that cat toy with a red laser beam. You got the cat chasing the red laser beam and not looking at the big picture.
So is there anything that the Democrats or the liberals are doing on the other side to combat that? Are there, because you see, they are so well organized in the ground game. And this is, like Mark said, is long term. I mean, they're in it for, I mean, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years. Is there anything on the other that liberals are doing to combat this or trying to do something on the other side that actually is, I don't know, maybe we could, you know, bring PR to facts and all the other important things, that morals and values and things and democracy.
Yeah, there's so much that's being done to shore up our democracy. There are people working on, you know, all the investment in democratic political infrastructure and voting rights, all the efforts to sort of shore up different kinds of individual rights, to bring true election integrity to our country, to defend the rights of every American. There are a lot of people of faith who are speaking out against this movement and saying this doesn't represent our understanding of the gospel or of moral values. And I think that's important. But we have to acknowledge that the religious left is not the equivalent of the religious right in any way, shape, or form. It does not do the same kind of exploitation of faith congregations to turn them into partisan political cells, although some people have alleged that Soul to the Polls does something along those lines. But I have not seen, for instance, you know, I've gone to these gatherings of groups like Watchmen on the Wall, which has tens of thousands of affiliated pastors across the country, or Faith Wins, which has, again, thousands of pastors across the country. And they'll go to these churches or mega churches and do events for dozens or even hundreds of pastors at a time. They give them messaging materials. They give them voter guides that leave. They're all about those, like, abortion, you know, defense of family values and same-sex marriage and, you know, their sort of idea of religious freedom, which is actually religious privilege, or the right to discriminate against others. So they give you these voter guides that leave people no question about how they're supposed to vote, their so-called biblical values. You don't see this on the other side anywhere. They'll give these pastors sermon starters. They give them instructions for forming within their churches what they call community impact teams, which is where the pastor doesn't want to tell the congregants how to vote, but he'll get a team of congregants within the church and they give them all this material and all these resources. And then these congregants will tell other congregants how to vote and sign them up and hold them accountable to vote. So you just don't see, and then data tools. Some of these organizations have actually offered like church voter lookup, where a pastor can look up their congregation, see what percentage of the congregations voted in the last election. They can even look up individual church members and see if they voted in the last election. And you can just imagine the conversations that emerge from that. Like, hey, Mrs. Jones, I see you didn't vote in the last election. Don't you know it's your biblical value, your biblical duty to vote? You know, I'm not telling you how to vote, but, you know, I'm hoping you vote in the next election. You should vote your biblical values. I mean, you can sort of imagine how that goes. I do not see any of this on the religious left. The religious left doesn't have anywhere near the funding of the religious right. So
it's all
not
tax-free.
Well,
it's all tax-free. They don't have to pay taxes on any of this, right?
Yeah, it is. There is that sort of, I would say, complete, you know, ignoring the Johnson Amendment, ignoring the sort of respect for the fact that they are tax-free, and the justification for remaining tax-free is they remain sincerely nonpartisan. But yeah, there still is a lot of private money going to many of these organizations, like the Alliance Defending Freedom, for instance. It has an annual budget last fiscal year of $102 million. There's an estimated over $1 billion or more of money going into this movement every year. The National Christian Foundation, which is a donor advised group, which also funnels money to a number of these various organizations, dispersed, I believe it was $1.5 billion in the last fiscal year or somewhere thereabouts. So it's just an incredibly well-funded movement.
What's it like going to those conventions and conferences, and do they know who you are? And do you have
to get out of the room and report, get some air?
And, you know,
I use my real name. I don't lie, and I try to keep, you know, my ears open. And I think sometimes listening is really hard for people. Sometimes when we hear stuff, we tend to try and reinterpret it in ways that are going to make us feel more comfortable. But it's important to listen. They say what they're going to do, and then they do it. You know, they're not hiding. It's just, I think some of those of us in the media, we have a hard time really taking them at their word. So I just go and I listen. I listen for what's useful. I always watch for trends. I watch for what's unexpected. And it's very interesting. Very interesting.
What's the next trend? What's the most unexpected thing that we should be on the lookout for?
I don't know about the future because I can't predict it, but I will tell you a couple of surprises in the past. Okay. Prior to January 6th, I would not have guessed that one of our major political parties would defend a violent insurrection against our Capitol. I would not have predicted that a political party would stand by as a former president stole or absconded with, or who knows, what was the hundreds or thousands of documents pertaining to our national security, and would push back on efforts to hold that person to account and to, you know, figure out what the hell happened to those documents, and would actually, you know, say that, you know, FBI director, who is frankly, you know, a Trump appointee, should be impeached because of it. I mean, that just really has surprised me, but it shows the depth of anti-democratic sentiment that this movement has inflicted on one of our two major political parties in our politics at large.
So what is you're an investigative journalist and you cover this. Do you think one of the problems is that people don't, are there enough investigative journalists? Is there enough storytellers out there who are really spending time diving in and educating the public? And give me a little bit of, you know, the state of investigative journalism. It used to be a lot of media outlets really invested highly in hiring and making sure that they had investigative journalists who could, you know, talk about these tough topics, uncover scandals and these kind of stories. Like, what is it the fact that the media has also, you know, we're not doing as much of this job? And that's also why this is able to increase and flourish?
I think there's a lot of terrific investigative journalism out there. I don't think that's the problem. I do wish there was, of course, more support for investigative journalism. It's very difficult for an independent investigative journalist, you know, to do that work, but there are advantages to being independent as well. But I don't think the problem is lack of investigative journalism. I think the problem, well, for a long time, you know, a lot of investigative journalism in this area is a little bit, is a little, I mean, late to the party. There have been wonderful people who have been on this beat for much longer than I have. I'm just going to throw out a few names, but I'm going to leave people out. I think about people like Michelle Goldberg, who wrote Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. I think about Jeff Charlotte, who wrote The Family. I think about Sarah Posner, whose latest book is called Unholy. I think about so many other folks, people at the Americans United for Separation of Church and State, who have been on this beat for a long time. There are so many others, some of the folks at Political Resource Associates and other places. But for a long time, they were called extremists. When people tried to draw attention to the anti-democratic nature of this movement, they were called extremists. I remember a former speechwriter for George W. Bush called this a movement that could fit into a phone booth. Well, the phone booth moved into the White House in 2016, refused to leave in 2020, and threatens to come back in 2024. And it's not a phone booth. It's stadiums all across the country. I mean, we really need to set aside these kinds of premature dismissals. I still hear people saying that demographic trends are going to save us. No, they won't.
Well, I was going to ask that. I mean, because is this the candle burning bright before it goes out?
Absolutely not. This movement is really still, you know, those organizational infrastructure is not going away. It's become, frankly, so extreme as time has gone on. And it's going to continue to sow chaos in our politics. And now they've got the courts that they want. And they're really excited about what comes next. So I do think that there's, you know, plenty of hope for the future. I also think that, you know, Octavia Butler had some great quote where she said, She said something to the, like, there are thousands of solutions and you can choose to be one of them. You know, there's like no, guess what she was saying essentially is there's no magic bullet, right? But there are so many different avenues of engagement and you can choose to be, you know, part of that, you know, struggle for our democracy or not. But so I do think there is always hope, but I think that we're facing a deeply authoritarian movement that is, frankly, you know, bent on seizing power and imposing a different vision of our society than most Americans would agree with.
So what country do you want to move to?
Where are we safe? It's happening globally too, so it's like you do have to be careful. You can't just move anywhere.
The Jewish billionaire from Chicago, isn't this against his, you know, greater good for him? I don't understand. I mean, I understand I get the why he might do it, but explain it to me.
I think for some folks it has to do with far-right economics. Like, I think about the Kochs. Frankly, I don't think they're motivated by any deep-seated religious convictions, although I can't speak for them. I don't know. But I do think that they're very libertarian or far-right in their economic orientation. So, you know, a lot of folks think that's the way to do it. You know, they want to concentrate power at the top, and they think that that's the best way to govern our country.
Because it's not really about religion, right? It's really about the religion of power and money. I mean, it's not, God has nothing to do with this.
I don't think God, you can't say God has nothing to do with it, because it involves Christianity. It involves the exploitation of religion and using that to manipulate people. And then I think when you're thinking about the religion piece of it, it's really helpful to remember that people can see things as being in their own, like on the leadership, it's a leadership driven movement. Two things can be true at the same time. They can truly believe in, you know, that, you know, abortion is a sin, same-sex marriage and all the like, but they can also believe that what they're doing that's benefiting them, you know, that they're arguing in their own economic interests is also what's right. Like, so they can, I think some of them are more sincere than others. I'm not going to name names, but there are folks I see in the movement who I think, wow, that's like a really cynical person. And then others who I'm like, man, that guy, he's like all in, right? But for all of it. But I do think that, you know, it's for a lot of the folks in the movement, it's very much about, you know, this different vision of how we're supposed to govern our country.
So I know we got to wrap up, but leave us with something. You said there's hope, because this has been very heavy and wow, scary. It's, you know, obviously That's because it is scary. But it, how do you see this turning around, or how do you see a way out? Is there a way out? I mean, are you seeing anything in your reporting that you're like, this gives me a little bit of hope?
I think hope is, you know, I'm going to paraphrase a friend of mine, Reverend Kelly Brown Douglas, the hope is in the struggle. You know, she spoke and has written about her relatives who were enslaved, and they fought for freedom, even though they knew they would never experience freedom. They fought on behalf of people they would never see. And I just think about how, you know, comfortable so many of us in our own lives, if we don't have it in us to fight for our democracy and to struggle for our, you know, restore our, you know, our democracy, then shame on us. So as Octavia Butler said, again, you know, there are 1,000 solutions and you can choose to be one of them. And I do think it's an all hands on deck moment. And there are things we can do as individuals, and there are things we can do when we join together. I think the first challenge is that people can't meet their challenges unless they know what they are. So bringing out information about what our challenges are is really important. Beyond that, I think there's no power for the substitute of the vote. I think it's really important to defend voting rights, to make sure every vote is counted. And then there are, of course, many organizations that are working on shoring up democratic infrastructure, work on various sort of issues, various rights issues and things like that. There are a lot of folks working on the solution, and that gives me hope.
But it's an all hands on deck situation, as you said, and I guess the meters are pointing to red. So we got to get busy, got to pick a solution and go fight for it.
How do people follow you, you know,
and name the books,
read your stuff? You have a couple amazing books that I'm sure they can just Google and find out, or wherever they get their favorite books. Tell us a little bit about how people can follow what you're doing and read up on all the information they really need to know.
Sure. Well, the paperback edition of The Power Worshippers just came out. It's called The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. My previous book in this area is called The Good News Club. It's really about, it came out in 2012. It's about the religious rights efforts to infiltrate and undermine public education. I tend to post most of my articles on my website, which is katherinestewart.me. And I'm on Twitter at Kath S. Stewart, KathSstewart. And I'm on Mastodon, but frankly, I haven't figured out how it works yet. So we'll see if I need it.
Yeah. The question is, have you paid your $8 to get certified or what?
No, I did not pay for my blue check, and I'm not going to.
Did you bring any booze to end this with? Because I could.
Sorry.
Well, thank you for enlightening us. This was very important conversation. I hope a lot of people listen, a lot of people read great articles. And thank goodness there are people like you who are diving in and not giving up educating people about these topics.
Likewise. Thank you so much for everything you guys do. And it's really been a great conversation.
Thank you. Thank you, Katherine Stewart. Thank you very much.
Wow, I'm so inspired to know that there are journalists like Katherine out there. And I tend to think, I guess I'm like looking at this half glass empty, because I tend to think that journalism out there, I don't see enough of it. But I was glad that she reminded me, hey, there's great people working in these fields. I think there need to be more. But she was inspirational.
Yeah, I love what she said. Hope is in the struggle. Go into a room and find the person with the most light and then ask them the question they didn't want asked. Yeah. That's a great thing to learn for any journalist. You can be intimidated or frightened, but if the story needs to be told, you tell it. And she calls it out. She doesn't both sides it. I mean, and you know, that was all stuff we got to before we got into the discussion of Christian nationalism, which scares the hell out of me.
Yeah. And it should scare everybody, because it's not, it's a political movement. Like she said, it has nothing to do. It does have to do with
it's a power movement,
but it's a power. Yeah. So we hoped you enjoyed this week's episode. After Deadline, the media podcast is a production of On the Mark. Media. If you enjoyed and want to hear more of our interviews with incredible journalists across the country, around the world, actually, be sure to follow us on social media at On The Mark Media and subscribe to After Deadline, the media podcast, anywhere you get your podcasts. Until next time, we'll catch up with you after deadline.